Good morning, everybody. Nice to see you all. Am I using this to change it through? Okay. Great. Good. So the last time I came was back in July. It was the graveyard shift. I think we had a good time. Whoops. What is this? It's a bit strange, isn't it? Anyway, good. I like to clear the decks a little bit, you know, get myself settled. We're going to be here for 3 hours, so that's what it is, isn't it? It's 3 hours, yeah? Yeah, that's what I was... John, you told me that. At least, good, yeah. And then discussion and prayer afterwards and the response, good. So, yes, I was here back in July, and I said that if I ever came back to again, I would carry on a little series I proposed, which was on rhythms of resilience. And so today I'm going to carry on that. A few years ago I did some work and preaching series on rhythms of resilience back at BGMC, and I spoke about 10 rhythms of resilience, things that will keep us going through life. And so today I'm going to do 5 rhythms of resilience, and if you want to hear the rest of the other 5, then you'll have to invite me back. That's the score on this. And so if you try to understand what resilience is, there is a definition by the American Psychological Association which says this: the process of adapting well in the face of adversity, trauma, tragedy, and significant sources of stress. Now, can anybody tell me, if you were here in July 2019 to hear me, anybody remember the video I showed? I showed a video, yes. Yes, it was an iguana being chased by a whole load of snakes in the series on the planet Earth by David Attenborough on the BBC. And there's a snake theme a little bit this morning as well I want to introduce, because within the handbook of the United States Peace Corps, is anybody in the United States Peace Corps, by the way? No, you're not. Okay, that's good. For the volunteers, if you're in the United States Peace Corps, you are getting a handbook which tells you how to deal with an anaconda if you come across one. An anaconda is larger than a boa constrictor. It is within the family of the boa constrictors, but it's generally larger than that. It grows to about 35 feet long and about 400 pounds. And so Amazon American Peace Corps volunteers are likely to encounter an anaconda. And so they've given them these 10 steps you are supposed to follow if you're attacked by an anaconda snake. And this is good advice for us here in Bow and Bethnal Green, I think. Number one, if you are attacked by an anaconda, do not run. The snake is faster than you. Number two, lie flat on the ground. Put your arms tight against your side, your legs tight together. Number three, tuck in your chin. It's very important. You've got 3 or 4 chins, it's going to take a little bit while, but... Number four, the snake will come and begin to nudge and begin to climb over your body. Number five, do not panic. Number six, after the snake has examined you, it will begin to swallow you from the feet in. Always from the feet in. That's very important. Always from the feet in. Permit the snake to swallow your feet and ankles. Do not panic. Seven, the snake will now begin to suck your legs into its body. You must lie perfectly still. This will take a long time. Number eight, when the snake reaches your knees, slowly and with little movement as possible, reach down and take your knife out and very gently slide it between the edge of the snake's mouth and your leg. Then suddenly rip up, severing the neck's head. Number nine, be sure your knife is sharp. Number 10, be sure you have your knife with you. Imagine doing all of that and then forgetting your knife. You've done all the not panicking, you've laid on the ground, you've been silent and still and waiting for the anaconda to suck in your legs, and then suddenly, where's my knife? Where's my knife? In any form of life, whether we're Christians or not, we're going to face stress and pressure and adversity. And we need the right resources to keep going through that stress, and those resources need to be sharpened. They need to be used, they need to be practiced, they need to be trained and honed in our lives. And so, we may not encounter too many anacondas on the Roman road, but we indeed will face guaranteed stress and strains and problems and challenges and difficulties, which you've heard about this morning already, which will challenge our ability to be faithful and fruitful for God in this world. And this applies to every form of human condition and not just us as Christians. And so I've come across a definition which I've changed and chopped a little bit, a very simple definition about what resilience is. And it is this: our ability to sustain a lifetime of faithfulness and fruitfulness for God. That is our core fabric foundation to our commitment as Christians. So an ability to sustain a lifetime of faithfulness and fruitfulness for God. And that is about looking after the condition of our whole self, body, soul, and spirit. It is about how there is a balanced equilibrium in all of those areas of our life which combine our whole. A few years ago, back in 2016, 3 years ago, we bought a semi-brand new car. It only had 6,000 miles on it. And it was one of these new cars which has got a lot of software, a lot of electronics in it. And it had 6 gears for the first time. I've never come across a car, or at least driven a car, or owned a car with 6 gears. And all of these electronics and the panels and the software was designed to maximize fuel economy and fuel consumption. And so it would tell you when you have to change gear. There'd be a little sign telling you at what point to change gear. And all these gear changes, and it will test you. You'll have a little bar, there'll be a little education panel, which would, you could turn it off, of course, but I quite like the thrill of having to compete against this education, and that's how sad my life is. But the whole idea is that after every journey, it gives you a chart of how well you braked, how good your fuel economy is, how your tyres are doing, and all that kind of stuff. So I was been driving this car for a while, and I'd been sort of noticing that my performance wasn't too good and all this kind of stuff. And you realise that actually when you're driving a car with 6 gears on, you have to change the gears really, really quickly. If you get up to 15 miles an hour, you should be really in second gear. And I think, I'm just not used to this, changing all these gears so much, especially round town. But if I decided one day to drive between Bethnal Green and Bow in gear 5 or 6, I would stall, of course. If I went down on the motorway in gears 1 and 2, the engine would be straining and catching on fire. The whole point of a system of a new car like that, with the software and the balanced equilibrium of it all, is to maintain the health of the car and to prolong the condition of the car. And in the same way, the balance between our body and our soul and our spirit needs to be in a balanced equilibrium in order for us to keep going in life through these strains and stresses. And we need the resources to keep us going. And in John Ortberg's book, Soul Keeping, he talks about how we are to look after our soul. Our soul essentially is our inner self, our core identity. It is the true seat of our senses. It is where our appetites and our ideas and our desires are located. And we've sung about that already this morning, and these are a few examples from the psalmist about a soul which is in distress, causing sorrow, my body and soul with grief he talks about, my soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. Where can I go to meet with God? The whole idea is that the very person that we are is located in our soul. And so these five rhythms of resilience are about soul keeping. And it is the nature of the soul to need. Our soul cries out, as the psalmist has already cried out. It may be physical distress, it may be something in the mind or the heart, but it's actually the seat of our emotions. And we know souls cry out for more beauty, more wisdom, more strength, more encouragement, more Facebook likes, more Twitter followers, more funny YouTube videos. Our soul needs all that kind of stuff, or at least we think it does. And our soul wants to be fed. But the trouble is, when our soul or our inner self looks for sources of nourishment outside of God, then we are on a wrong diet. Our souls need to be fed in the right direction. And when our souls aren't fed on things in the wrong places, then there is a balanced equilibrium in our soul, and we wither and we die. And essentially, that is called idolatry. It is the definition of idolatry, where our soul is fed on something other than God and his kingdom. So, number one is... which one is it? Is it this one? Let's look at that one for a moment. That's Peter. Dear friends, I warn you as temporary residents and foreigners to keep away from the worldly desires that wage war against your very soul. So the whole idea is that there's something going on against our soul which we are to wage war. And these rhythms of resilience are part of that struggle and that war. So part of the war is confession. Or confessio, as is on there. When I put these slides on, it worked okay. It's just the way it translates. So confession is what we're called to do as part of our rhythm, first rhythm of resilience. Because if our soul yearns for something and it directs or it is directed towards something other than God, then idolatry needs to be confessed. Confession, as we've seen already this morning, is the daily surrender of our souls to the rule of God. That's as simple as it is. And confession diminishes sin's power in us, and it ignites the resistance against idolatry. And we come in our lives to God knowing that we can't sustain a life of fruitfulness and faithfulness. We can't keep going without the daily rhythm of confession. And confession and repentance give God a consent to work in our lives. Such is the nature of God and his work in us. He needs our consent to work. And sin stops us, presents before God a sort of barrier to him working in our lives, because the life that we have with God is consensual. And so we are giving permission to God's Spirit to work in our lives when we confess. And it unleashes, therefore, wholeness and resilience. Our next one. Let's just look at Psalm 38, verses 3 to 8 for a moment. Because of your wrath, there is no health in my body, there is no soundness in my bones because of my sin. My guilt has overwhelmed me like a burden too heavy to bear. My wounds fester and are loathsome because of my sinful folly. I am bowed down and brought very low. All day long I go about mourning. My back is filled with searing pain. There is no health in my body. I am feeble and utterly crushed. I groan in anguish of heart. It was an incredible description of the way in which a person's soul, their personhood, their identity, is consumed with a sense of confession and throwing themselves on the rule and the reign of God. The next one is presence. Now, if you have got a big television at home, and I don't have one, but I have one in what is called HD, which is high definition, for those that don't know, I came across this advert a few years ago, and it said this for a high definition television: imagine being able to see every blade of grass as on the football pitch as your team scores the winning goal. Now, I support Leeds United, and although we're second in the league, we haven't been scoring too many goals at the moment, so I haven't been able to see the glory of scoring a winning goal, let alone in real life, or on telly, or even on HD at the moment, because we're not scoring too many. But the fact is that high-definition television, or a presentation of the visual complexities of screens, is based on a sharpened focus. The whole idea is that you have a depth of connection with what is on that screen, which is, in one sense, a better ability to see life. It is being alive to the detail of what you're seeing. It is a better sense of attention you get through high definition. And being present, fully present in the world, is about being present in the world in high definition, being attentive to God and his work in the world and the needs of others. Now, I'm an A to B sort of guy when I'm traveling. I like to get to places in the quickest possible time. I love journeys. I love holiday journeys. I love small journeys, but generally I want to get to somewhere as fast as possible. That's a car, my bike, or my walking, and it frustrates my wife very much. And I have learned, and this is learned a lot through Jeff, actually, of the years that we used to go out prayer walking, about the ability to be able to see things around me, which I wouldn't normally see when I'm concerned with speed, when I'm concerned with getting from A to B as fast as possible. And when we would go out prayer walking, we would be out walking and walking around like this, and at the end we'd stop somewhere in the corner and Jeff would say, "Mike, tell me what you saw or heard and reflected on there as you walked past all these streets." And I'd be going, "I don't know, Jeff. I mean, I'm just, you know, there's a dog over there and there's a few blokes over there and a couple of shops open there and a few things shut down there." His mind worked on a different plane to mine. But I gradually learned of the ability to hear and to listen and to see things in my own environment, which I didn't see before. And that is about being present in the moment. It is about being in place at that point in time and being able to see things with God and with others that you haven't seen before. And we live in such preoccupied lives, distracted lives, that we forget by being in the moment. And part of that is about technology. The vice president of Microsoft said this, that we live or have continuous partial attention syndrome. And this is a person whose company was almost single-handedly responsible for a technology revolution. And this stresses us out. We're always connected, always available. Our inbox, whether it is a phone or a PC or a Mac or another device, is overloaded with messages. We have 570 WhatsApp messages on our 10, 13, 15 groups that we have. We have voicemails. We have notifications coming. How many notifications do you get per week with the software notification, a Facebook like, an Instagram like, a Twitter feed? All these notifications coming in and updates available, and they're shouting for attention. And there is so much more in life that shouts for attention that really does need our attention. And so we are people that are drawn to things which don't need our attention. And the result is that we fail to be present with God and present with people in that moment. And the presence with God and with people gets diminished, and our relationships wither and die. So we need an orientation, a reorientation, around a rhythm of presence, of being with people in that moment, undistracted, unavailable, listening, hearing, watching, learning. And in the same way, that goes for other elements of our lives as well. Our workplace, our community, our family situation, our spaces in our physical environment and community. The next one, the third one, is absence. And presence and absence are complementary rhythms. Being alone, being still, being silent is something which I really don't like very much. I'm an E personality. I get my energy from being with people, but I've learned over the years that sometimes I need a bit of silence and a little bit of a quietness. But urban life is pretty much insulates you from absence, from being away from noise or image or activity or speed. And we swim against the tide very often, where we're always on and always available and always active. And it is absence which should teach us to stop and to be silent and to find creative breathing spaces where we are living in an uncluttered space, even for a moment. And it's hard for us to do that in an urban setting, in busy family, work, church lives. But it's necessary to keep us going. A few years ago, when we went to a park as a family, and I've been told, Lorna tells me, and tells this story quite often, that we're in this park, and the kids were old enough to play on the swings themselves, and we were just enjoying the sun and just sort of lying and eating a bit of food and drinking and stuff. And I always get a bit fidgety after a while. And so I said to Lorna, Dylan and Darcy, they're getting bored. And she said, no, they're not getting bored. It's you that's getting bored. They're perfectly fine. Look, they're happy. They're enjoying themselves. It's you that wants to move on to the next thing. And it was probably right. I wanted to move on. We'd done our 15 minutes on the swings, and I wanted to move on and do something else. It was time to do something else. Surely we need change. We've got to be constantly moving on. And I've learned that I've had to, against my personality preference, my natural inclination, to actually be still and to be quiet. And sometimes it goes against who we are as people to do that. What is wrong with the first line in these words, which is rectified by the second line? Yeah? No spaces. Yes. What about reading this? Let's eat, Grandma. Let's eat, Grandma. You may have come across this before. Punctuation, it saves lives. Saves grandmas from being eaten. Space, pause, punctuation makes life intelligible. And it gives it meaning. And that's what we need. It keeps us going. It gives us resilience. It gives us depth of the resources when we are present in people's lives and with us and with God. But we need that complementary act of absence, where we understand the slow rhythms of God. The slow rhythms of God. The patient, slow rhythms of God, which we can work with and be with and sit with and be still with. And our churches are so filled with activity and mission and change and moving on that it's great to hear that you are part of a week of longer prayer. And I know that's part of the tradition here in Victoria Park. A chance to listen and to hear and to be present and absent, because prayer is not an absence from the world. It is a presence of being with the world, but it is another sense of being able to be absent from some of the distractions, but still present with the needs of others as well in that moment and with God. And sometimes we need to adopt this new rhythm of absence in order to keep going. And perhaps Lent is a good time to do that as well, as that comes up in a month and a half or so. So let us be committed to make sure that technology must serve our rhythms and not be our master. So I've got two more. Let's move on these quickly. Remember, uns e. So the next two again are related. Part of our lack of ability to keep going under pressure is forgetfulness. We forget who we are. We forget we are God's children. We are reconciled. We are forgiven. We are deeply loved. We forget who God is. God who is always loving and who's always for us. And we forget that we're in a struggle. We forget we're in a battle. We forget we are in a war, which is both cosmic and communal, and it is also individual and personal. And Israel and the Old Testament points to a strategy of remembrance, remembering as an antidote to forgetfulness. Intentional and deliberate acts of remembrance and celebration were part of the fabric and the formation of Israel as a nation, as it progressed and understood its nationhood and its identity before God. And in order to keep going, Israel needed to have within it the formation of these festivals. Can anybody name some of the famous festivals within the Old Testament or even within the New Testament? Anybody name any of them? Passover, yeah. Jubilee, that's another one. Yes, tabernacles, but that's a similar sort of thing, yeah, yeah. So you've got a number. There's first fruits, weeks, Pentecost, trumpets, Day of Atonement, tabernacles, new moon festivals, Sabbath festivals, we've already said the Jubilee festivals, unleavened bread, all those kind of ones. When you look through the Old Testament, you'll see that Israel had this really strong rhythm of festivals and celebrations in order for them to remember who they were and how God was working in their lives. It was an orientation towards celebration. Holy days, holidays, was remembrance about God's work in their lives. And it was, again, orientated around a year-long period of festivals. From this day, remember, each year, from generation to generation, you must celebrate it as special, as a special festival to the Lord. It was the whole idea that each time you come together, you remember what God has done as an antidote to forgetfulness. And as part of this is thankfulness. Thankfulness as the complementary rhythm to forgetfulness and as an antidote to forgetfulness as part of this rhythm of celebration. Our soul needs to have within it a rhythm of gratitude each day. It moves us from austerity to abundance, from scarcity to plenty, when we get a renewed vision of the gift that we are given in this world. And the celebration, the dual celebration that we need to have, that we need to incorporate in our family life, in our work life, in our home life, in our communal life as a community, we need celebration. And the celebration is based on thankfulness and gratitude. And both of those are powerful antidotes against pessimism, against bitterness, against a critical and judgmental spirit, against self-orientation. Thankfulness is the great enemy of narcissism because it enables us to take time to recover from the amnesia we have in our lives, that we forget who we are, we forget what God has done, and we forget we're in a struggle. And so this week, we need to be orientated around a rhythm of seeing life as a gift, all of life. Whatever element of life that we engage in from the moment we wake up, We are to see life as a gift of grace, whether it is the food that we have on the breakfast table, for the clothes that we put on, to the work that we're going to do that day, whether it is paid or unpaid, from the gift of friendship, from the water that we turn on with the tap, from the human contact that we have people, with the diversity we see in our community, with the joy that we get from reading a book and going to see a film, from gathering together as God's people, for the natural world to the man-made world. Life is a gift. And when we are broken by life's terror and strains and tragedies, we still need to have this foremost vision in our mind that life is a gift from God, and to lead to the celebration of that in thankfulness and in remembrance. And so, as we finish, let us read this. Blessed is the one whose delight is in the law of the Lord, who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. So we need to water our soul. It needs to be watered in order that it doesn't wither and die. Because if it withers and dies, it fails to produce fruit. So we need replanting. Replanting in these new rhythms. We need to plant our soul in these five rhythms. Now, of course, you've got five more to go, so you know you can still carry on planting your souls in these things without the other five, because you won't hear about them until the next time I come. But the fact is that confession and presence and being with God and being with others, absence away from the intrusion in our lives, the acts of celebration for remembrance and thanksgiving give us the ability to feed our souls and to enable us to keep going through the pressures and the strains of life that we experience. Let's pray. Perhaps there may be a chance for some